Welcome to Beautiful Business, the podcast where functional evolves into beautiful. And now your host, Stephen Morris.
Well, 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 today on The Beautiful Business, I'm so very happy to welcome my colleague and my dear friend, Sarah Sandercroach. Sarah is an internationally recognized LinkedIn specialist, an online presence mentor, the author of two wonderful books, and I think she has a new one coming out. She is a podcaster, a self-described hippie turned business coach, a master marketer in a highly humane fashion, which is very unique in the world of marketing, and a deeply thoughtful and humane voice in the world of marketing. She lives and works in beautiful Switzerland, and she spends part of her time in Sicily. Welcome, Sarah, to the conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve. It's such a delight to be able to spend this last hour of my working Friday with you. So excited to talk to you.
I love it. Well, my day is starting out here in Southern California. You are across the world in beautiful Switzerland, and I'm sure you're enjoying fall. You were telling me a story right before we started to record about Sicily and your time there. Do you want to just talk about that real quick?
Yeah. So ever since, you know, that we lived in California for a few years, and ever since we moved back to Switzerland, we missed the climate and mostly the palm trees also in California. And so a few years ago, we purchased a home in Sicily. And so we've been going there. My husband is originally from Sicily. He grew up in Canada, but that's where his parents are from. And so we've been going there, spending time there. And I talk about my alter ego in Sicily. I do speak Italian when I'm down there. And so really, when you speak another language that is so completely different from English, you turn into this kind of different person. I'm kind of more relaxed and more like bella vita, you know? And so it's just a great place for us to spend some time. And what I was telling you just before we started recording is that for the first time that we've been there, and we always go in October, now this time it's just been like extremely rainy. And then just yesterday I came back with the boys, and my husband is still there. And the torrential rain really turned into a hurricane. They call it a medicane for the Mediterranean. And this is just like unheard of in Italy. So much rain is unheard of. And it just kind of, yeah, God is very concerned, and you know, with everything that's going on in the summer, they're going through fires, just like you guys are in California, and now we have floods everywhere. So I kind of entered our call in this weird mood of, yeah, you know, seeing things that are going on, being a bit very concerned, but also thinking, well, it's time to act. We got to do something. We got to change things and fast. So that's the Sicily story.
I love it. Well, and my heart goes out to the people of Italy and all, everyone who's been affected by, you know, climate change. I, like you, have a handful of friends there. You probably have a lot more. I don't speak fluent Italian, but, you know, I've spent a fair bit of time there. And one of the things that strikes me about Italy is their celebration of beauty and their ability to live day in and day out with this sort of, you know, relationship with beauty in the natural world that's around them, and even the sense of artisanship and the way that they live their lives. And, you know, to see these kinds of, you know, global events and global warming types of things happen, not just to them, but to everyone who is trying to live a thoughtful life. And, you know, it's part and parcel to the work that folks like you and I do, where we're trying to actually make a difference in the world. And, you know, like you, I get quite fired up when I begin to hear about these things, and my mind, instead of, you know, for some people might throw their hands up and say, I give up, I go into action and start to focus on some of the things that I can control and contribute to make this world a better place. So my heart goes out to those folks, and I hope your home there is A-OK and survives all of this. So I'd love to start with this question, Sarah. How would you describe the business that you're in?
It's so funny you asked that, because just today I was on a walk. We always, we live next to a lake. And so whenever we go walking with friends, or even if I go by myself, I try to go to the lake because, you know, water, it just, you live next to water as well. It just has this soothing quality. And so we were, this is a business friend, but also a life friend. And we discussed about this new paradigm and what changes. And we actually said, well, do we really still call it a business, the business that we're in? And they used to use, like 5-10 years ago, they used to use this term lifestyle business, but it was kind of a gimmicky term, and it usually came with pictures of people sitting at the beach and I make money while I sleep, and you know, that was the lifestyle business. And that's definitely not the kind of business I run, or I, you know, kind of want to be associated with. But I do also you know, think the terms business really is changing. Like while I was in Sicily and it was raining, well, I was doing some work. I wouldn't actually maybe say I was working, because it didn't feel like work. And it didn't feel like, oh, I'm giving up my vacation and so now I have to work and it feels really bad. No, I enjoyed so much what I was working on. So I think this term business is actually like is like getting a makeover. It's changing a lot. And the way I think of my business is just where I put out what I think I'm good at. I help people with what I'm good at, and I'm getting paid for it in return. I think that's what my business is about.
Yeah.
I don't have a really good answer, Steve, to be honest.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you're in that liminal space where the definitions of things are either growing, expanding, or reconfiguring. It is hard to put words to the feeling of navigation that we go through when we're in that transition or transitory type of period. But right. It does sound like there's this approach, and, you know, I've had a fair bit of conversations around this, around the idea of integrating a way of living and a way of working. And it sounds to me like you're alluding to, well, certainly you live that within your business. But it also sounds to me like you're alluding to the world of business seems to be changing in a broadened definition of it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, no, I really do think so. And you know, the pandemic was just an accelerator. Some people call it a trigger. I would say it's been triggered even before the pandemic. The pandemic just maybe accelerated things, and more people do, you know, start thinking now about, you know, how they want to make a living, because in the end, that piece will probably not change for the, you know, next few years. Is we still need to make a living, and that has to do with trading your work or services against money. And so really it comes down to, well, what do you do? How do you make a living? And how does that fit into your life? And I think that's where the conversation is changing. And when I, like, my husband and I have very different ways of making a living. He's still in a big corporate kind of surrounding. And even there, things have changed. They are more flexible. The fact that he, you know, can work from home or from a distance, that's very new. But even there, I think there's still a lot of things that need to still evolve, because things that used to work will no longer work in the future. So yeah, a lot of transformation, I think, going on in that whole business paradigm.
It's interesting. You take the phrase make a living, and mm-hmm. you know, the presupposed or, you know, pre-assumption that goes with that, at least the current sort of approach or definition, is that that has to do with how we work. But, you know, if you just look at the sort of foundation behind what that phrase could actually mean, make a living, it actually has more to do with living than actually working, right? So, you know, maybe there's maybe it's time for a reclamation around what does it mean to make a living, and it not being solely centered on what our vocational path is or entrepreneurial journey or the businesses that we run. It could include that, but it could also include a much broader definition of how we see the life that we want to live and how we want to live through this, you know, wild and precious life that we have in front of us.
Yeah. And, you know, you alluded to it earlier, that the Italian lifestyle or the people in different cultures and not just Italy, I think there is so much we can learn from these cultures that have more of this living oriented lifestyle where, yes, they work for a living, but the living is the most important piece. And whenever I come back from Sicily, or I am in Sicily, I really, you know, pay attention to that. And even my kids, they're now teenagers, but even 10 years ago, they're like, wow, look at people. They're just much happier here. How come? They still work, but they're just happier. So I really think that we need to look, and, you know, to these cultures and say, well, where did we go wrong? How come, you know, they are happier? Or maybe I think the word that comes up is this definition of success. How come they maybe define success differently than we do? And we find ourselves in this hustle after always more and more and more. So yeah, just some reflections that I come back with usually from Sicily.
So it's interesting. I'll segue into this. I listened to your conversation with John Jennings, who's a mutual friend of ours. And for folks that don't know, that Sarah and I are in sort of a mastermind group with a gentleman named Chris Cooper, who runs the Business Elevation Show. And John is also part of that. And in that conversation, you and John got into a really interesting discussion around what's called the Great Resignation or the Big Quit. And I loved your dialogue, and maybe you can share it here about the Great Resignation and your concern about that sort of language. But I also, more potently, I'm curious about, you know, going back to what we were just talking about, this, you know, reset that has come out of the, you know, the pandemic, or as we begin to come out of the pandemic, wherever we might be in that. And I'm not sure that we're fully oriented there. You know, what do you think is actually happening at the core of this reset and even the big quit or the Great Resignation?
Yeah, I really think it comes back to values. That's what's been happening over the last 18 months to 2 years. People really, you know, think, is it worth it for me to be stressed all the time, to travel, to not see my family? Is it worth it for me to, you know, always go bigger? Is it not just worth it to just go home, you know, instead of always go bigger? So I think that's what's been happening. And so no wonder so many people, especially people where, you know, they don't feel actually valued maybe at their workplace. So they're like, well, I feel much more valued at home. Why would I want to go to a place where I don't feel valued? So that's kind of the process that I think they have been going through. And so they're just like, well, I'd rather quit. And hopefully, I think what they're all hoping for is to find something better where they actually do feel valued for the work that they're putting in. That's my gut feeling. What do you think, Steve?
Well, there's so much to talk about here in that. And the way I tend to think about this, my mind goes into the heart of the pandemic. Back, let's say we're recording this in October of 2021. So let's say a year ago. And what I envision a lot of people experienced, not just here in the US, but I think globally, was probably not all that dissimilar from what me and my family experienced, which was we were sequestered into a relatively tight confines of a social community and our home, and including the way that we worked and interacting with the people that we work with, be it clients or coworkers or our bosses, whatever. And we spent a great deal of time reflecting on and perhaps even reclaiming a sense of flow in life that had to do with a closer alignment to our value system, or even maybe a more close consideration of what is our value system and the way that we want to live our life. And now as we come out of the pandemic, I'm seeing kind of one of two things happening. On one side, I see people jumping right back into the quote unquote rat race, you know, the responsibilities, and they're hitting the ground running as if none of it ever happened. The pandemic. And then I think a larger part of our population, and this has to do with not only the sort of the world of the people that I work with, but even the cultures that I serve and organizations that I serve. I see a lot of the employees wanting to reclaim or continue the reclamation of that value system and the manner in which they were living life, whatever that might mean for people. And so there was a lot of work around connection and community and tight-knit communities where people, and I think we were, and this goes to your point, we were heading in this direction before the pandemic, but the pandemic, I think, sort of forced our hand a little bit, where our personal stories, our work stories, our life stories were melding together. And I felt, and maybe this is part of the sort of global movement around businesses with purpose or business for good. I felt like people wanted to live a version of wholeness that they felt possible. And perhaps in the pandemic, we saw what the possibilities were within that. And now we're wanting to put them back into a more normal, everyday, calm, less anxiety-ridden society. Right. And it feels to me like it's perhaps a healthier way or a more holistic way to do both work and life.
Exactly that. What you mentioned, it gave most people, you and I, we already have probably this space for reflection and pause and slowing down because we've built that into our businesses. But most people, employees especially, who had to commute to go to their work, you know, for an hour in the morning, an hour back, eat, put the kids to bed. Like there was just no time at all for any of these reflections. What do I actually value? What's important to me in life? I call it the trance that most people go through life in trance. And then that's why, you know, once they actually finally retire, they find themselves with all this time to reflect, and it's often ends up in, you know, depressive thoughts because you're like, oh my God, my life just went by and I didn't do what I wanted to do. So this pandemic gave us this pause to reflect. And you're right. Now people are like, well, I actually finally found out what I value in life. Now you want me to go back to how it was before? Yeah. No, thank you. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's part of the big quit is the no thank you and the striving towards freedom, sense of freedom, a sense of wholeness in people's lives. And they, you know, for the most part, the employees of, you know, that typically work for corporations, but even those in entrepreneurial worlds, they are wanting to live this sense of wholeness day in and day out because they saw it was possible. And I want to do a little bit of a left-hand turn here, or what might seem like a left-hand turn. But I suspect that there's some connection to the thread of this conversation. You grew up in this, what you call a peace and love environment. And as I understand it, a commune of sorts. I'd love to hear a little bit about what that was like. I'm utterly fascinated by that world, and I wonder how that colors your today's perspective.
Yeah. So yeah, I grew up in the 80s in Switzerland, and my parents bought an apartment building together with five other families. So we each had our own apartment, but there's a lot of common places in the house, and doors were always open. We us kids, there was about six kids, we always spent time together. We ate at each other's houses, and it was basically a community, a co-owned house. And so there was a lot of common decisions. I remember, I think at least once a month, if not more, there were these meetings that were being held among the adults. So they would eat together first. And then there was like these official meetings where us kids, we had to, you know, go to another apartment to play. And they had like all these decisions to be made. And notes were kept, and like it was a very organized community. And I think what I learned from that was this co-living, co-sharing, collaboration, and you know, equality, fairness. My parents and all of the members of this small commune, they were very politically engaged. And so, yeah, I really grew up in this place of, yes, love and peace, but at the same time, also kind of very, very practical, very pragmatic thinking of how do we collaborate and co-live in a space that was not that big. So we always had to kind of like compromise. And so what's interesting is that I grew up there, and I left when I was 16. I left the house when I was 16. And then also slowly, I guess as the kids grew up, the parties would like move out and they would kind of dissolve. People were still in touch. We still celebrate Christmas with the members of the community every year. But people went their own way after that. And for me as a teenager, it was, on one hand, I did appreciate having this community a lot. Like it was just like, well, that's where I grew up, but that's how it is. But I did notice, of course, when I went to school, that that's not how everybody else's reality was. It was like completely different. And it was very strange for my friends to come over and have these people just walk into the door. And I remember my first boyfriend, he's like, can't you lock at least your room? So yeah, it was very strange and different, of course, for everybody else. And that as a teenager, you know, it's hard. You want to be just like everybody else. And so what happened after moving out, I really kind of started to hide these stories away. I'm like, well, that's no longer me. I want to just, you know, be like everyone else. I want to go into business and do my thing. And so I'm actually just started telling this hippie upbringing story a few years ago, like 4 years ago. And for the longest time, I was kind of hiding that somewhere. And really, Steve, it felt like a part of me was not there. I was hiding behind the mask. And so now we're talking about feeling whole. Well, now I finally feel whole, that's out there, and that I actually realize that makes who I am. And it also has all these qualities for, you know, the work that I'm doing now, growing this community of humane marketers, bringing more humaneness to marketing. That's how I grew up. It was all about humanity. It was all about, you know, being compassionate, being fair, being equal rights for women, for men. Back then, it was mainly women and men. So yeah, I feel like I've come full circle, and I just love the fact that I can share that story now.
I can only imagine that and this is true for all of us, the upbringing that we have absolutely has to have an influence on the value system that we carry into our adulthood. And sometimes we're running away from the childhood that we had, but it also feels like this sort of full circle thing as we come into a more mature version of our adulthood and even eldership, as our dear friend Gene Early would say. And part of that is also a reclamation of who are we holistically, and how do we unfold the complexity of human life into all that we are, and bring that into a way of living, a way of working that also inspires others at the same time. You talked about, and I'd love to get into this a little bit more, how this has influenced your approach to marketing and humane marketing. And I think I pulled this quote from your website that says, "Marketing has become a dirty word, a source of mistrust and a nightmare for many entrepreneurs." So, you know, I wonder, can you talk a little bit about what you mean by this dirty word and what the antidote to that might be in the way that you think about marketing?
Yeah. So my business really grew up during the last 10 years in this online marketing world. And you know a bit how that looks like and how it evolved. It really has become this overhyped attention-seeking space where, you know, the person or the business that yells the loudest gets the most attention. And that for me has just, it's become this kind of cyclone that just kept on spinning until that one day when I said, well, I can't do it anymore. There's just too much anxiety. I feel like I'm so totally out of integrity. I can't keep doing it the way I've been doing it in the past. And even, you know, in the past, I've always been aware of what I'm doing, and I've always tried to at least do it a bit more my way and not just a way that the marketers out there would tell me. But still, it felt not good to me. And so this day came where I decided I can't do it anymore. There needs to be a better way that we market our businesses. And it really has to do with the hippie story, because I felt like we're not being humane in our marketing. We're not being, you know, authentic and with integrity. We're always wanting to sell more. That's the only thing that marketing wanted us to do, or that people kind of understood. And that's where the dirty word comes in. It's like, it's this thing that we do in order to trick people into sell more. That's, I think, the definition that a lot of my clients, yeah, they felt like they can't do it anymore. So that's what I was up against. I was like, well, there needs to be a better way. And that's kind of what the gentle business revolution, that's how that got started. I'm like, well, I need to do business in a more gentle way, in a more humane way, that is not about manipulating, that is not about tricking, it's not about lying, it's about bringing the whole self to your business. And so it's kind of the opposite of what we've been taught to do in marketing, really.
Yeah, it's I wondered in the work that you do, what you bump up into in terms of either resistance, hesitation, questions for people who are introduced to the world of your world of humane marketing. And I can imagine, just, you know, putting myself in the shoes of an audience member who just begins to learn about Sarah and the work that you do. And, you know, I think about the disarmament or the freshness of the word humane put in front of or associated with marketing. And I wonder what you bump into with questions that people have about, or even resistance that people have about well, what do you mean by that? And how do we actually do that? What does this look like in action? And how can I infuse this into my business?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff to unpack here. So there's two types of reactions. There's, you know, the curiosity and the, oh yes, please tell me more. It's like a breath of fresh air. I want to know more about this different way of marketing. And there's definitely, you know, too much hype. And yeah, so tell me more. And then there's the other reaction where it's kind of the more skeptic. It's the analyticals who say, well, how do I know that this works? I need this to work because marketing is meant to sell more stuff. And so I need to have facts and figures, and you need to show me proof that this works. So those are the two types of reactions, and they're both obviously valid. Our left brain always does want to know whether something works. However, the kind of the counter response I've come up with is the question that you need to ask yourself, if you're asking, you know, does it work? The question you really need to ask yourself is, does the way you're doing it now still work for you? And I mean like work in terms of numbers, but mainly I mean in terms of how it makes you feel. How do you, you know, if you feel like into your gut, does it make you feel good, the techniques that you're using? And if it does, then great. That's awesome. You still use the old way of marketing. But if you have some doubts and you're like, yeah, actually, you know what? I don't like using these techniques, even though maybe to some extent they work. I had the business that worked, you know, but it didn't work for me anymore. So it's that question, like, does it work, and does it work for you? That is, in my opinion, more important, because if it doesn't work for you, most likely it doesn't work for your clients either, or it won't work. What I've seen is that the old marketing techniques, the manipulative, the shaming, they work to attract instant audiences, and they work to, you know, to add money to your bank account. They don't work to build a sustainable business. And so you will never escape the hustle, because you have to keep hustling to get more into the door.
Yeah. And so would you, if I were to offer, well, perhaps the argument is, do you want to play the short game or the long game? And yeah, the short game is in the world of business. And all entrepreneurs get to choose the way they play the game of business. So the short game has to do with, we're going to defeat the competition. We're going to, you know, do all the things that you're describing, which is, we're going to be, you know, highly curatorial in the way that we, you know, present our social media feeds and all of the marketing that we put out there. We're going to put a sunny face all the time. We're probably going to overpromise, and maybe we're going to underdeliver, and we're going to chase customers and try and beat them down into submission versus wooing them. And in the other side, which is the sort of the long game of doing business as it applies to marketing, which is, you invest into the quality of your product or service. You share stories about the value of that. You keep telling those stories to the right people out there in the invitational manner that you attract them, create this sense of magnetism that I talk about in Beautiful Business. Right. And, you know, I it's so interesting. I love the way that you think about marketing in this very, very humane way. And I want to tell you a quick story. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine about the word marketing, and she comes from an agency background. She's born in the UK, and in her 20s, she was telling me a story that she, you know, like a lot of people do in their 20s, traveled through Europe. She got a Eurail pass, and I think she spent 6 months traveling through Europe, and her first stop, you know, from I think London is where she left. She went over to Paris, and she had the opportunity to be taken in by this older woman, as she described her, in the heart of Paris. And, you know, here she is in her 20s, and she's taken under the wing of this older woman and, you know, infused within her daily rituals. And one of the things that this woman did is she would every day, first thing in the morning, she would take her, you know, when she'd get dressed up, take her little wicker basket and go down the market and do what she called marketing. And marketing to her was going, and this goes back to the Italian, Sicilian type of artisan life. Mm-hmm. She would go down into the neighborhood and pick and choose amongst the delectable delights, the things that enlivened her world, the breads and the cheeses and the fresh fruits. And that to her was marketing. And I thought, oh, goodness gracious, that is just an amazingly beautiful definition that I had never actually thought about. You know, we in the English language, we twist our nouns around into verbs all the time. And to have a sense of agency from a shopper or consumer perspective in the way that we delight in finding products or services that fill our worlds, I think it's just a great way to think about marketing on both sides of the equation.
It really is. And you know, to kind of align it with your beautiful business. And you wrote a paragraph or two in the Marketing Like We're Human book about the importance of making marketing more beautiful. And I think it's so key to make that distinction between the way we're doing marketing now and, you know, kind of this digital transformation that we've been going through and that people still are stuck on, even though, you know, yes, it's great that we have all this technology and it's amazing, but let's move on, or kind of like, let's move back to what really matters. And that is the human connection. And it is also the beauty. So I think actually during the kind of the research for the book and also just kind of like coming up with humane marketing, I came across Daniel Pink's book again, called The Whole New Mind, Why Right Love Brainers Will Rule the Future. And so just kind of this importance of creativity, beauty, the right brain. That is going to be so different. And that's where this breath of fresh air comes in. It's like, oh, it does not have to all look the same or sound the same or be like a template, or, you know, so that's where marketing really becomes also easier. And it's definitely not that dirty word that people think of, because it's creative. It's different.
So take us behind the curtain a little bit of the world of humane marketing. I know that you have a 7 P's approach. Do you want to share a bit about what that looks like?
Yeah. So the 7 P's of marketing, or 4 P's of marketing, is not a concept that I came up with. That's been around since, I think, the 60s. But when I looked at the 7 P's of marketing, I just kind of thought, well, you know, that needs an update. It's kind of very outdated. There's still P's that stood for physical evidence and place. So like kind of these things that nowadays with all our online presences don't matter as much. So I threw some of the P's out and brought in some other ones. And the ones that I did bring in were passion, personal power, and partnership. And then the other ones are people, product, pricing, and promotion. So the other four are the same, but the new ones, they are really much more about the being and not so much about the doing. Because what I've realized over my decade and more of being an entrepreneur is that those entrepreneurs and businesses who do well are really the ones who do that inner work and you know, think about their purpose and their passion and why they're in business. And I know that that's also part of the work you're doing with your clients. So that matters a lot in marketing. And I tell my clients to bring more of them into their marketing. That's how they will be different. That's how marketing is more easy. It comes from within. And yet we've been taught the opposite the last 10 years. Marketers always told us, it doesn't matter what you think. All that matters is what the client thinks. Mm-hmm. It's not true. I don't believe that it's true. What your client does look to you, and they do kind of cross-check whether you are a good fit for them, you know, whether they want to buy from your company. I talk about a lot about worldview. Your worldview matters. Putting your values into your marketing, that matters. And so all of that is part of your being. It's what you stand for, that once you start to share those stories, that's when people resonate with who you are as a company. And so your framework of magnetizing is very similar to how I structured my book as well, Marketing Like We're Human. I have the three R's: rumble, rise, and resonate. And so resonate is like you're magnetized. Mm-hmm. It's like, we are, you know, thinking the same way. We just know that our values are aligned, and that's why we want to work with your company. I think that's really important today.
I completely agree. And when you think about, and I'll just bring a touch of psychology into this, the way that the way that people make decisions is that, and there's tons of science behind this to support it, is that we intellectualize first. So we're going to do the data analysis. We're going to make sure that the product or service makes sense for our world. And this sort of falls into the equation of we don't get confused into anything. But as customers, be it in the consumer world or the B2B world, we don't make decisions until our heart and emotions are engaged. So, you know, when you think about something like magnetism and resonance, for instance, those are not things that we think about. And so if we were to ask the question, well, do you feel or do you think magnetically that you're attracted to this company or this brand or what they're producing, or is it something that you feel? And obviously people are going to land on, it's something I feel. And so when people's emotions are engaged into the heart and soul of what that business is offering, then all of a sudden their emotions are connected to that. And this is why it's sort of an energetic thing, to that offering that that company is making. So the customer then feels emotionally or energetically connected to the offering at hand. And all of a sudden now we're in this thing called relationship. And relationship happens on a very emotional level. And again, you know, even if we're buying a car or, you know, the bread down at the market or the latest craft brew or, you know, shopping for the next product or service from a B2B company, we have to feel emotionally engaged and connected to the organization and the people that are making those products. And I think about this quite often, like the thought experiment, and this goes back into some of the things that you were talking about with, the Italian culture, for instance, is if as a shopper, we go out into the world, we can close our eyes and we can imagine the world of possibilities in front of us from a shopping standpoint. And let's say, for instance, we're looking for a new laptop. And that laptop, there's many different laptops out there and there's many different brands that sell laptops. It is the ones that we feel most closely connected to from a feeling standpoint that we feel is going to fulfill our life and our lifestyle are the brands that we're actually going to buy from. It's not the ones that make the most sense, although it does have to add up from a numeric perception. You know, the price has to be there, the position have to be there in a laptop scenario, all the specs have to be in place for the productivity that we want to have. But we're only going to buy that laptop once we feel like it's the right decision. How do you feel about all that?
Yeah, it's that unique differentiator. It's not always the price. It's not just, is this the cheapest? People are not making decisions like that anymore. Maybe for kind of like commodity products, maybe. But I agree with you, especially in the service business, and that's how people make decisions. It just while you were talking, I couldn't help but thinking about what's going on with Facebook right now. And if you think about, what this company stands for and how that will most likely impact, how they're gonna evolve as a company. It really does matter what your worldview is and how you live that in a company, how you treat your employees, how you treat your stakeholders and everybody involved, your clients, of course, your customers. And yes, right now they're still making billions, but who knows? Is this gonna really be a long-term sustainable business, or maybe have they made some mistakes that are non-recuperable? I don't know. We'll see.
Part of me wants to go into the rabbit hole of that conversation, and part of me is like, well, that's a big conversation to have.
It is a
You
big
know,
conversation.
I talk about, and you've probably heard me say this, where I talk about what I think a brand is really about character. And by that, I mean, I tend to think about the world of business, and even the world of marketing and sales from a very humanistic perspective. And so if we think about what is character? Character is the culmination of how a company or a collective group of people in an organization feel about who they are, their, to your point, worldview and their value system, and how they show up and live that value system day in and day out. And that sense of character creates an imprint on all of the people who are involved on both sides of the product or service consideration. So the employees and also the customers and, potentially even community and investors and partners and things of that nature. So when we think about, the character of Facebook, they can change. I think they have the opportunity to evolve who they are, but it would take, I believe, some very corporate soul searching and maybe even a deeper exploration of what is actually do we stand for before they go out and, reposition the company, which I know that they've already done and talked about, rebranding and things of that nature. I think none of that is going to take root unless they actually change the heart and soul of who they are and redefine or elevate their sense of character and then live themselves, behave themselves into that.
Yeah, it's that inner work, but that's the thing, right, Steve? That's the work that not every company is willing to do because, well, it's not like there's instant results. It's not the doing, it's the being. And so that takes some, it takes time out of just running the business and actually do some deeper reflecting. Not every company is willing to do that.
No, yeah. I want to shift real quick into a conversation around a new book that you have coming out around selling. Do you want to talk about what that book is about and what your perspectives are on sales, as sales and marketing are kind of inextricably connected?
Yeah, so Selling Like We're Human is coming out pretty much around the same time as your beautiful business book. It's an interesting book for me because never in a million years did I think I was going to write about sales. Because if I think about all the activities in my business, selling is probably the one that I until now would have said, oh, don't like it. But it's one of these things where, in marketing, we have this concept called give your clients what they want or sell them what they want and then give them what they need. And so I realized after talking with my members of the Humane Marketing Circle and my book coach and other people, well, what people really want is to sell. We want more clients. We want to sell our services. And what's needed for that is you need to market more. You need to, you know, resonate with your clients. And so I gave them what they needed, but now I had to go back and actually give them what they wanted, which is the sales part. And so it really took me quite some, not convincing, but I needed to sit with it and kind of block out all the sales advice that I've ever learned. And I worked with many sales coaches, and on my drive, I found out that I had probably purchased more sales programs than I should have. And I needed to kind of just forget about all of that and say, okay, Sarah, if you forget all of that, how would you want sales to be? And how would it really feel like selling like we're human? Between two humans, or, you know, from one to 100 humans, how would you want to sell? And so that's the book I wrote now. And it's really an answer to a request from my clients. And the beautiful thing, talking about beauty, the beautiful thing is that I didn't want to write it alone. I said, well, how, you know, let's sit together. And so I called the Humane Marketing Community. I said, look, who's willing to get into a gentle sales lab and talk about what should be in a book about selling, about humane selling? And so together we came up with the content, and then I sat down and wrote the book. And I really feel like I've written a beautiful book that is completely different from anything I've ever read about selling. It talks about a serene garden where you sit down under an oak tree, pull up some chairs, and sit with your potential client in this serene garden where you are in control, but you're also very serene and you're just having a beautiful sales conversation. Mm. So yeah, I'm excited for the book to come out.
I love that. And I envision the person being quote unquote sold to in that particular environment. And, you know, you talked earlier about the, you know, sort of the dark side of marketing. You know, one could argue or make the case perhaps that selling even has a darker side to it, or, yeah, you know, painted with a very dark palette, if you will. But I imagine in that garden scenario where, you know, on one end of the conversation is the person making the offering, and on the other end of the conversation is the person making the consideration, they're much more at ease in that particular setting. But especially the customer, because, you know, it's interesting. We don't want to be sold to as human beings, but we want to buy stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that has to do with, we want to have some sense of control or agency over how we make decisions. And we would only be tricked into something that isn't either right for us or valuable for our world. Or we also don't want to feel pressured to get into a relationship with a business, which is really what it is, that is trying to trick us into something. And I can't wait for this book to come out. And I think it's really, really important to tether these two ideas together of marketing and selling.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it really is all about empowering your clients. And you do that with, you know, telling the truth in your marketing, and you do the same thing in selling. It's like, there's no more lies. There's no more, it's all out there in the open. And I think now more than ever, that's what people want.
So as we begin to come a little full circle here, the topic of this podcast is, you know, the theme of my book, The Beautiful Business. And kind of the cool thing about beauty is that it's very subjective. And so if I were to offer the phrase a beautiful business to you, how would you describe that?
Yeah. To me, it's a business that respects the triple win. That's kind of the framework I talk about, and it's a win for the planet. So to, you know, kind of come full circle how we started this conversation, right now, what we as individuals need to make a priority, but especially also businesses need to make a priority, is the planet. So whether that is people, animals, water, land, whatever, somehow I think businesses need to make the planet a priority. So that's the first win. The second win is the people. So of course, your own people, employees, and also your clients. You make a people a priority. And you do that by, yeah, treating them well and not tricking them and all of the stuff that we discussed. And then of course, the third win is for the business itself. So meaning profits and meaning money and success and all of that.
That's great. Are there businesses or brands that either businesses that you've worked with or brands that you buy from that might fit that description?
Yeah, I feel like luckily there are already businesses that fit that description. And what I always come back to is the B corporations. And one of them I kind of talk about in the Marketing Like We're Human book is based here in Switzerland, called Babuk. They make footwear from sheep wool. And I really love how they, you know, they treat their community, they treat their employees, they make sure that everything is sustainable in terms of where they get their products and suppliers. And so I really feel like they are a beautiful business, and you can tell from how they do their marketing as well. It's really marketing to a community. It feels like, as a customer, I belong to something bigger. So that's what I would refer to as an example.
My book. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes, and sounds like a phenomenal company. So last question I have for you is, about once a year, I publish a list of books for my readers on my blog. And it's a sort of a category of books that I call non-business books for business leaders. And the reason I think that this is potent, important, and it gets a lot of traction, people, you know, respond very heavily to, like, oh, I love this list, is that, you know, we as business leaders, you know, we do a lot of our own research and reading sort of within the industry, but I think it's the things that sort of fuel us that come outside of the industry that actually make us more whole and get us thinking differently, more creative, more innovatively. I wonder if there's any books that you might think of or recommend that fall into this category of non-business books for business leaders.
Yeah, I have two that I'd like to mention. The first one is one that we've just been reading together in our mastermind, which is The Fourth Turning by, I think it's Neil Howe and maybe some other author. You'll put that in the show notes. So that's kind of I wouldn't say dark, but it's definitely a kind of an explanation of maybe what we're going through right now. So it's a history-based book of these different cycles that we go through as society. And it explains that basically we're now in the fourth cycle. And after the fourth comes another one, which is the first. And so, yes, it's a bit dark, but it's also very hopeful, because we can see in history that, you know, other civilizations have been through these four cycles, and there's, you know, something new coming. So that's one of the books. And then a completely different one is 10% Happier from Dan Harris. Mm-hmm. I find that a great book, especially for guys. I'm saying that because I got my husband into meditation with that book. And so I'm very grateful to Dan Harris. It's a funny book about meditation, how Dan Harris, you probably know him better because I'm not familiar with who he is, but apparently he's this big reporter, right? On, I don't know, mm-hmm. one news channel. And so he started meditating and he shares the story. And it's just really a funny read, but that is actually very also pragmatic, and he shares, you know, this is not going to make you 100% happier, but it might just help you with 10% more happiness, or probably happiness is not the right word, but more more ease or help with dealing with certain things. So if any of your listeners are, you know, kind of playing with this idea of meditation, but it's just too hard to get into, that might be a good read for those skeptics.
I read that book several years ago, and I found it to be a very grounded and accessible entry into the world of meditation and mindfulness. And Dan tells some really great stories within it, including, which I loved, how transparent he was about this anxiety period that he went through. And there's this famous sort of on-air episode that he had sort of this anxiety panic attack on air, right. And which was a big pivot impetus for him to get into the world of meditation. Exactly. And I just really appreciated, to your point, his sense of humor about, you know, or lightness about meditation, and even like his skepticism within that book, yeah. Around, well, you know, I wasn't a believer, trust me on this, but I will tell you that it has made me 10% happier, which is the great premise of the book. Yeah. So I'll be sure to put both of those books in the show notes. Sarah, thank you so much for the conversation here today. It's always a joy and a pleasure to spend time with you. How can folks connect with you in the world?
Yeah, thank you. The pleasure is all mine, Steve. Thanks so much for having me. So I have two websites, humane.marketing. That's where you find out more about marketing the humane way. If people are interested in the kind of the 7 P's and maybe work through them in order to understand more how they show up in their business, I have a one-page marketing plan that's at humane.marketing/1page. And that kind of guides you through these 7 P's of humane marketing. I also have a podcast, which you've been a guest on and will come back on. It's called Humane Marketing. So you can look that up wherever you listen to podcasts. The other site is sarahsarancroce.com. And then you most often find me on LinkedIn.
Wonderful. Again, Sarah, thank you so much, and enjoy your beautiful day and the end to your week, and good luck with your book launch.
Thank you. Same to you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Beautiful Business with Stephen Morris. Make sure to follow the podcast so you don't miss an episode. To download a free chapter of Steve's book, The Beautiful Business, go to beautifulbusinesspodcast.com. Again, that's beautifulbusinesspodcast.com.